may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is David Bailey. I'm here representing an adjacent landowner and a landowner a few hundred feet away from a sand and gravel operation which was the result of a special use permit issued by the county. I will pass on the details of the case, and if I may, and if I have answered all the questions of the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. If not, I will simply answer every question the court has. That's far more important. We're here on demur. And the really important part about the demur in this case is, of course, you have the standard issue of a very detailed complaint. Some might say more detailed than necessary, but nonetheless, a very detailed complaint alleging facts for multiple issues, many of which the court has granted error on. Now, the traditional rule for a demur is you accept those facts as true, unless they're conclusions of law, and you go from there. You don't decide the facts of the case.
Well, but you have a couple of principles that are at stake right up front before you even get to that question. Special exception is a legislative act. It has a presumption of validity. And we know that eventually you're going to get to the question of whether something is fairly debatable. And as a result, the burden rests on the party attacking it to establish that it's unreasonable. So you look at the pleadings, you start with a presumption even before the first bit of evidence is considered.
Correct.
So on the face of the complaint, we have at least twice in recent memory sustained demurs because the complaint itself was sufficient to demonstrate that it was fairly debatable. So it seems to me that it's not odd that it was done on demur. Why isn't it appropriate given the standard and the presumptions that apply?
Well, first of all, if you have factual allegations, they are accepted as true, then it becomes very difficult for a court to look at the complaint on its face and determine, as the trial court did, that because there are multiple allegations, then it must de facto be reasonably debatable down the road. Therefore, I don't need to look at it anymore.
Well, I think what the best that comes out of that is that you have to look at it count by count. There may be some things that are demurrable on the face of the complaint and some that aren't. So perhaps you ought to single out whatever counts you think are improper to resolve on demur.
Well, I think the court did that when it granted a limited amount of errors. We had a number of issues that we alleged. There were arguably issues of law, and I certainly don't debate the fact that the trial court could look at what was an issue of law. Was the Dillon rule involved in some issue or not? And make that ruling.
Well, you have, this you have court, counts 5, 8, 9, and 10. 5, 8, 9, and 10, that's the counts before.
That's what you...
Pick your best count and respond to the chief's question, which is, when you look at the allegations and you look at the attachments, is it rational to believe that the presumption could be rebutted if further evidence were heard? So what's the best count, and how do you filter it that way?
If I have to choose the first count, most important is always in zoning cases, it's arbitrary and capricious. Now, that obviously also is a count where the trial court might have more leeway in looking at factual issues to determine if, you know, I can bypass all of this and go straight to a decision. The problem is what you have is argument. You see it in the brief, and it was before the court. You have the Board of Supervisors arguing points, saying, well, we did this, we did consider that. But that's evidence. That what you're trying to do is convince the trial court that the evidence we say as the respondent is going to be presented, you should accept as true and buy it. And
well,
we don't even get a chance
to argue that. You have to go directly to a subject matter and not a concept of arbitrary and capricious. Count 5, non-compliance with the comprehensive plan. Comprehensive plan doesn't have the status of a zoning ordinance. It's advisory. Now, how could that fail to be an appropriate demur?
Riverview Farms said that, Riverview Farms, decided by this court, said that an alleged violation of the comprehensive plan is a condition which could require proof. And we allege that the board's own staff said it did not comply with the comprehensive plan. We allege that the board's own statements at the hearing said basically we don't have to comply.
Riverview involved a circumstance where the comprehensive plan was required by statute. And that's the point. It's not here. This is an advisory matter.
Well, all local governments have to have a comprehensive plan.
And they may very well, but it doesn't have the status of the statute. That's important.
That's correct. It's not directly enforceable, but it is evidence of arbitrary and capricious action. If you don't comply with the comprehensive plan, and we made multiple allegations about that particular point, then that's evidence of arbitrary and capriciousness. Now, again, if this court wants to say, and certainly the respondents are arguing vigorously for that, if you want to say that, well, okay, the comprehensive plan could be debatable, so therefore no evidence is going to be allowed, we're just going to go straight to the end point, it's debatable, in which case you're going to say that land use claims are essentially dead in this state.
No,
and adjacent landowners
that
will
can't
lose
be right, because the test is fairly debatable. It's just like the concept of reasonable inferences.
Right.
This is not really unique to land use law. This is the way demurs work generally. The question is not, is your fact pattern correct or is the other side's fact pattern correct? The question is, given all the facts that are presented both in the allegations as well as the attachments and the debate between the two sides, could a reasonable fact finder conclude, or for that matter, when it's a question of law, a reasonable court conclude that this debate is fair. Not that this side's right and this side's wrong, but in fact, we don't even choose winners and losers on the merits. We just ask ourselves, is one side, is the government being unfair in debating this point? Is it so obvious that no reasonable municipal government could debate this point?
If you take that view, which I would respectfully suggest, I don't think this court has taken either on demurrers or on land use cases. If you take that view, the principal claim that a person challenging a land use decision is their burden to allege an arbitrary and capricious action. If you take the view that because the plaintiffs have alleged facts showing that this is going to be potentially debatable, you've got to wait for evidence, you don't have any evidence. If you take the idea that arbitrary and capricious, which is debatable on its face, almost by definition, then you have no zoning cases. Every case would be a trial court could say, well, they alleged arbitrary and capriciousness. There's a lot of facts in here. Undoubtedly, they'll be debated. End of story.
Well, if you look at Cheney's position, they say that we actually have to ignore our precedents in Eagle Harbor and EMAC. Could you address that?
Eagle Harbor, that was a... I think the cases they cited are very bad for their position. In Eagle Harbor, you have a case which follows a couple other cases that are done this way. And that says basically, if the parties get together and they have a key document, a contract, agreement, or rule, ordinance, whatever, and they both agree to submit it to the trial court and say, you know, this determines the case. And judge, if you decide how this applies, we don't need to go through the rest of it. And that's fine. That's fine. You're putting an issue before the judge. The judge decides this is a controlling document, and I rule. But that's not this case, and that's not an arbitrary and capricious case or any of the other issues we've raised. That's an agreement of the parties to submit almost on summary judgments, which usually done, on a particular issue which decides the whole case. And that's entirely different from what we have here.
Counsel, I'd like to go back to your comprehensive plan argument briefly. I'm one who thinks that comprehensive plans ought to be complied with, but they are indeed advisory, and Riverview Farms is distinguishable on the facts because of, as you well know, it was a proffered rezoning, and because of the nature of the proffers, the comprehensive plan becomes something beyond advisory based upon the proffer statute. Do you have any other case where a failure to abide by the comprehensive plan would lead to a conclusion of arbitrary and capricious?
No, but I will say this. We never allege that the failure to comply with the comprehensive plan as a matter of law was made this illegal. We said that is evidence of arbitrary and capriciousness. Throughout this whole case, all of our allegations go to a complete pattern of arbitrary and capricious actions running from the comprehensive plan to the no-noise controls, to the treatment of the military, to the whole way in which they have addressed this issue, all evidencing a clear pattern of arbitrary and capricious actions, many of which, even if reasonably debatable, would not necessarily be, could be handled that way, particularly the conflict of interest issue.
Well, one of the things that's striking here is you have a very detailed permit. So in other words, it wasn't like the locality just said, we're going to do this without explanation. And so, for instance, on noise, there's detailed conditions, and so on down the line. So why, I mean, there's no dispute the permit itself was properly before the circuit court at the demur stage, correct?
That's correct. We alleged it, yeah.
So why don't the detailed terms of the permit itself fatally undermine your position?
Do you deny us the right to prove that those terms are either illegal or inapplicable or arbitrary and capricious? In noise, for example, we allege that they've attached a condition for noise which their own ordinance says is not applicable to sand and gravel operations. We also said there was no noise studies. There was no determination of what noise levels had to be applied.
But if so, doesn't that take us well beyond fairly debatable and into circuit court? You're a super board of supervisors, and you can second guess the adequacy of what they came up with.
No. With all due respect, my landowner has some little modem left to protect his property. And that is for him to be protected from an arbitrary and capricious action which denies him the right to protect every little modem he's got left.
And maybe we just have a different understanding of arbitrary and capricious.
Well, I hope not.
Well, at what decibel level does noise become arbitrary and capricious? At what level do conditions controlling noise become arbitrary and capricious? I mean, I don't understand how your logic would not lead to exactly what was suggested, which is circuit judges sit basically as super zoning boards. Why would we be taking evidence on decibel levels? The question is, could reasonable people debate this stuff?
You might be able to debate it if there was one, but there wasn't any.
Wasn't any what?
Any decibel level set.
Well, isn't that a debatable point, that you've got to actually come up with a decibel level?
Well, unless we assert, which we did, that the failure to set specific sound limitations is an arbitrary capricious act which affords no protection to the adjacent owner. And remember, in a special use permit, go to the statute, a special use permit says you are to impose conditions to protect the surrounding property. That's a very narrow statutory requirement in a special use permit. It's different from just general zoning. The county has an obligation to take certain actions to protect that adjacent property owner from this special use. Remember, this is a special use to a zoning condition. It's not rezoning. So that statute there is different. And the landowner has a right to some protection against a willy-nilly decision to do this because the county likes it. I am almost out of time.
In the time remaining, would you focus on that last issue having to do with a fraudulent petitions and the reliance on the count 10?
We allege that agents of the applicant, they had a pork farm at the facility, they took the pork products and they gave them away at free food. And when they gave them away at these free food stations, someone was there with a petition saying, please sign here to approve the project. Apparently, the person who was assigned to do that was not very successful in getting petition signatures, so he created his own.
But tell me, I understand the facts of the complaint, or at least the allegations. Tell me how that translates into something that invalidates the board's decision.
The allegation, I'm sorry. The allegation was the board relied on the presentation by people that the citizens of Caroline County...
Who on the board relied?
Primarily the two board members that we accused.
How many members are there of the board?
Five. Of six.
Six. So did a majority rely?
Well, we don't have any...
Do you allege that?
We allege that at least two of them... We allege, actually, that the board itself relied because they put them in the record. There was conversation by some of the board members, particularly the chairman, who said, you know, wait a minute, we need to look more into this. But those petitions were not rejected, and they were comments by the Board of Supervisors members after the close of the hearing. The citizens want this project, and we allege that they relied on those fraudulent petitions.
As a trial judge, I heard a lot of false testimony in lots of different ways in cases, and it got into record, but I didn't rely on it. So how do you, I mean, the allegations, I don't think, actually sustain the idea that the board relied on it to the extent that it resulted in the approval of this particular special use.
Again, one element of a multiple cascading arbitrary and capricious action. I agree with you. There is no specific evidence because I can't read the minds of the board members. From the proceedings that occurred, we allege that we believe that the board did rely on it.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Good morning. I'm Richard Stewart, and I represent the Moss Neck entities. Also with me is Grayson Haynes, who represents Cheney Enterprises, and Lee Berg, who represents Caroline County. I will tell you that in a vote of 2-1, I lost, and I'm going to address the Court today while they watch.
Are you addressing on behalf of all of the appellees or just the appellee whose brief you signed?
I am addressing on behalf of all the appellees, Your Honor.
So if I have a question for one of the other appellees, you would be authorized to respond to it?
I'll certainly do my best.
Okay.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
Can you mind us directing attention to various things? In this case, do you mind if I get your attention directed to a few things?
I would appreciate it, John.
Focus on the noise aspect of this case, and there are several conditions of the permit that address it. I can actually name them if you'd like. Conditions have to do with. Here we go. All right, you've got a number of paragraphs. You've got 11, 13, 16, 17, and 18 actually address noise, traffic, etc. It seems to me that from the briefs and from the comments here, that opposing counsel suggests that basically they don't establish anything. That because there's no noise studies, etc., and they don't establish anything. They don't actually do anything of significance to ameliorate noise, traffic, and safety concerns. That's what they allege, and I think you probably ought to address it.
I will, Your Honor. Mr. Bailey had three separate hearings on this issue, and I say that because he amended his original complaint two times. And out of 184, 185 numbered paragraphs in those complaints, it progressively got longer, there was never anything more than a general allegation. There wasn't a specific allegation of how someone would be affected or how they would be harmed. And you talk about the effects of traffic, noise, dust, etc. But it was never anything specific and a specific harm in any of those complaints.
Well, I also thought count four, which was really the noise,
yes,
you know, we didn't grant.
Correct. But I still am going to answer the chief.
Right, I know, I understand. I just wanted to, I wasn't suggesting you not do that. I just was asking you how that fits into your...
Well, count five is what I'm talking about.
But Chief Justice, even if you think he did plead something, it is apparent on the face of the record that the Board of Supervisors, within those 35 conditions of that permit, addressed that. And the applicant actually agreed to be bound by a noise ordinance of Caroline County that otherwise he wouldn't be bound by because it was a commercial entity. And so we believe that that addressed that situation anyway. At least, you may not think it was a reasonable condition, but it was at least fairly debatable, which is what the standard is in a legislative act.
Counsel,
yes,
let me focus on that for a minute. And I think my colleague's comment is certainly correct that count four isn't in front of us, but the allegations of count four are incorporated in count five for purposes of an arbitrary and capricious analysis. And I do note that your client agreed to abide by Chapter 68 of the Code of Caroline County, the noise ordinance, and the noise ordinance is pretty detailed. The noise ordinance does include, though, in Section 68.8, a number of exemptions. And one of those exemptions, which is G, and I quote, noises emanating from any area permitted by the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy, or any division thereof. So in condition 24, your client says, we will abide by the noise ordinance of Caroline County. When you read the entire noise ordinance of Caroline County, including the exemptions, it exempts your client out of the entire chapter. Is it your position that that exemption is included in Condition 24, or does Condition 24 only include the restrictions on noise?
They voluntarily agreed to be bound by the restrictions in the ordinance and waive the exemption.
Exclusive of the exemptions?
Yes.
Great. Okay, thank
yes,
you, Counsel.
And I would submit to you all that this case really stands for the proposition in Rule 1:4 that brevity is enjoined as the outstanding characteristics of pleading, because it was exactly the 185 number paragraphs of either conclusory, speculative conclusory allegations or other facts that actually rebutted his allegations within the pleading that gave the lower court enough to sustain the demurs, all of our demurs. And I think it's important to go to the cases that he cited. He actually relied on two separate authorities. He relied on Justice Powell's dissent in EMAC or EMAC, however you pronounce that, which I don't think is persuasive in this case with my perspective.
Never a good idea.
Well-reasoned and well-planned as it was. I don't think it's persuasive here. And in Riverview Farms, and as the court has pointed out earlier, Riverview is actually a rezoning case with voluntary proffers. And I think it's 15.2-2297 subparagraph A, subparagraph Roman numeral 5, little III, that says you are bound by the complaint if you offer proffers. Now, that's not true if you come under the other section of the comprehensive plan, which I think is 15.2-2223. It's a guide to harmonious development, to accomplishing harmonious development. It's advisory It's what the General Assembly wants them to do in order to try to create harmonious development. And besides that, we're a special exception. And I think it's important to point out that even in Mr. Bailey's complaint, I think it's paragraph, it's page 18, paragraph 29, he asserts that to the court. This isn't a zoning case. Zoning authorities aren't applicable. This is from his own pleading. It's a special exception, and the board may only impose reasonable conditions on that special use because it's not a use by right. And he was actually right about that in the plea. And that's where we find ourselves, and that's why Riverview is distinguishable from the case at hand. But I would also point out in Riverview, they actually had specific allegations of how the plaintiffs were harmed by infringement upon their use of a right-of-way that was for agricultural purposes by the others using it for industrial purposes. And Mr. Bailey never went that far in his complaint and really put specific allegations of harm in our complaint. Now, I'm going to try to deal with these, each individual count, and I will try to do it as expeditiously as possible. The count number 8, the protection of the military base, and in his complaint, Mr. Bailey's argued that the county failed to protect Fort A.P. Hill pursuant to section 15.2-2283. I would encourage the court to look at that statute as well. That statute is implicated again upon a zoning action. It's not a zoning action. This is a special exception. This property was already zoned for gravel mines, gravel pits. And
well, do his right at the outset, do his clients have standing to bring to the court the interest of the United States military?
I don't think that they had any standing to bring causes of action on behalf of the United States military. Congress has to do that anyway. But in all fairness, I'm not sure that's what his allegation is. I think he's saying that the board has an obligation to adhere to that statutory provision. And as you're aware, there's a long laundry list of things under that statute designed to provide reasonable protections to various things, not the least of which is the approach to airfields and military bases. And I would submit to the court that largely the reason for that is when you have a military base like Little Neck in Virginia Beach, and you've got jets coming in and out all the time, and folks start building houses around the perimeter of that, the jets start coming overhead, people start complaining and calling their supervisors and General Assembly members, and then they say, well, we probably don't want houses up next close to these bases. But in this particular instance, it's applicable to a zoning action, a rezoning case, and that's what the statute specifically addresses. This property's already zoned for that. Despite that, the board did incorporate dark sky technologies, as Mr. Bailey pled this complaint, in order to address the base commander's concern with regard to night training. Now, again, we may disagree on whether that was a reasonable protection, but I think reasonable people could disagree about whether about that action, and thus it makes it fairly debatable.
And they certainly considered it. I mean, that's not in dispute. The commander came in and spoke with them and so on.
The minutes reflected, and Mr. Bailey pled it and referenced the minutes in his complaint. Clearly, the base commander came in, stated his view. It appears that, from the record, the board addressed the concerns of the base commander.
Well, one thing's for sure, if they didn't, the base commander will be back in another action.
Exactly.
That your approval will have no authority over.
If they had not addressed what the base commander's concerned, I would have been surprised to see some federal action on this matter.
Right.
But at any rate.
What about the conflict of interest, the COIA business, of the failure to recuse themselves?
Chief Justice, that's the one that probably made me scratch my head the most. In this case, he's pled that they violated an appearance of impropriety and standard and had a conflict of interest. I think, as we all know, there is no standard for a legislator to avoid an appearance of impropriety. I'm not saying that maybe there shouldn't be, but there is currently no standard under the law for that. The issue of a conflict of interest, what he has said, he has pled what I would call a bunch of really inflammatory stuff that I think was designed to inflame the passions of the court, and you read it, and it just looks like something bad must have happened. Somebody must have done something really wrong here. But he stopped short of saying that any member of the Board of Supervisors took a bribe, had a quid pro quo, had any personal gain, made any deal to get anything. The upshot of this thing is they were raising money for YMCA for the kids of the county. And he never even says that anybody got a donation for that. It
brings new meaning to the term political pork, though, doesn't it?
There was a lot about pork, Justice Mim. You know, I laugh about that, and I shouldn't, because I will tell you, this count is something that I found particularly contemptuous, because it's the reason it's getting harder and harder to find good people who are willing to serve in any legislative capacity because they don't want to have to go through stuff like this. But anyway, I don't think there was anything there. I don't think they violated anything under the FOIA statute. And in fact, they had an opinion of the county.
Well, the fraudulent petitions issue under count 5 is of the same character.
Fraudulent petitions, very quickly. Mr. Bailey pled that there was free pork given away, that people signed petitions, that in fact it appeared that there were even deceased persons' names on those petitions, that upon the Board of Supervisors figuring all that out in the hearing, in the public hearing, they disavowed the petition. That's the end of that. And that is enough for the trial court to sustain a demur on that count. And I would ask you all to affirm the lower court's decision in this case with regard to all of those counts. I'm sorry I'm out of time, so I won't address the standing. Unless you want me to.
Well, I do have one question about it. I must admit that I thought the partners had standing. But if the entire complaint is demurrable, it doesn't matter, does it?
No, sir. If you all affirm the lower court ruling on the demur, then obviously the case goes out by that. But I'm prepared to argue standing if you want me to. I ran out of time.
I think we'll just move on to the next case on the docket.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Call the next case.